and welcome to Celebrating Cinema, a podcast for the love of cinema. I'm your host, Sophie, and today I'm in conversation with writer and director Ira Sachs to talk about his new film Passages, which you can watch on Mubi starting today, the 27th of October. In honor of the release, we were invited to attend the film's Dutch pre-premiere right here in Amsterdam earlier this year and to talk to Ira afterwards. Well, hi, Ira. Thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to speak with you today.
Thanks for having me. Yeah. Very nice to be here.
I'm very excited to talk about this film. I've seen it twice in the past 4 days.
Okay.
I've seen it the first time to prepare for this interview, and then I was again there yesterday during the pre-premiere and your Q&A, which was lovely to attend. And I'm very excited to talk about this film because I have to say I was a bit hesitant to watch it again within 4 days,
right?
Because it's quite soon. But I loved it equally as much, if not more. First, because it was in a cinema, which is objectively a better setup than my laptop at home.
Yes.
And it was really nice to watch it in a room full of people.
Yeah.
And to hear other people react with me to the film,
because
there were a lot of noises during the film, and I always feel like that's such a connecting experience, especially for a film like this, which is so intimate.
Mm.
And then again, you also feel kind of closed off by it to a certain extent. To experience that with other people was very interesting. And I loved how the film was introspective, but yet also very speaking. It made me uncomfortable by decisions the characters make, but it was endearing at the same time.
Mm.
So I'm excited to dive into it with you. But before we do, maybe you could give a short summary for our listeners who won't have had the opportunity to see it yet.
So the film is called Passages. It's a story of two men, a couple, who live in Paris, and the woman that one of them has a relationship with. So it's a love triangle about desire and want.
Yeah.
And it stars three extraordinary actors, Franz Rogowski, Ben Whishaw, and Adele Exarchopoulos.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, when you watch the film, you're watching the three characters they play, Tomas, Martin, and Agathe, but you're also really watching these three actors. I think part of the intimacy is what they give the film and how revealing they are.
Yeah, I fully agree. They were tremendous. And I was actually wondering about that because you've said that you wrote this film for Franz Rogowski, who plays Thomas, the center of this love triangle. And I thought, what came first? Was it the idea for the story of a love triangle and then Franz was the inspiration for the character? Or was it the inspiration of Franz that came first and then you created the story around him?
That's a good question that I almost don't remember. I feel like I hold in my head certain memories of certain performances where an actor, an actress, a performer does something on screen that I'm just really turned on by.
Mm-hmm.
And that was true with Paulina Garcia, who's the star of the film Gloria.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote a film called Little Men for her. It was true for Isabelle Huppert. I wrote the film Frankie for her. And it was true for Franz. I saw him in Michael Haneke's Happy End. And go to YouTube and watch him do a karaoke scene to a song by Sia.
Oh, wow.
And it's really, you will understand why I wrote a movie for him. And it's on YouTube.
Oh, I'm really curious about that. Because when you were talking about this physicality of his and the sort of sensuality as well that you saw in his character, when you were talking about that, I immediately had to think of it's a very short scene in your film where we see friends dancing from the back in the restaurant.
Yes.
Which was such a short shot, but I was so intrigued and sort of entranced by it as well.
I love to hear that because I can remember considering that scene, was I going to shoot it? Was I not? It's a restaurant. And then I thought this is maybe a time for a musical interlude, like a dance scene. But there was no real justification for the scene except that I wanted to see it. So I kept thinking, no, I'm not going to do it. We're going to run out of time. No, maybe I will do it. No, maybe I won't do it. And then I was like, oh, come on. They're all here. They're great looking. let's turn on the lights, turn on some music, and we're going to have this dancing.
Yeah.
And it becomes really significant in the movie. It's a moment of impact on the audience. And you're always trying to think of images that create that kind of impact and stick in the mind when people leave the cinema.
Yeah, it truly had an impact on me. And it also makes me think of how in the entire film, composition plays a big role. And especially the thing that I noticed the first time around watching it, but the second time even more, that for a large part of the film, we're watching people's backs, which creates such a refreshing sort of intimacy that felt very new to watch for me.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a result, not an intention. Meaning, I'm interested in how the effect of watching bodies move through space. Mm-hmm. And so I tend to cut very little, and often I'm changing the size of the image by someone being, let's say, in a wide shot in the far end of the room, and then they walk towards the camera, and they're suddenly in a close-up. But yeah. I haven't used cutting to get there. Mm-hmm. And what that sort of means is that I don't always get to cut just because somebody's not in the right position. So my voyeuristic position as the camera isn't always privileged. And I think that's where the back becomes interesting. And sometimes I think it becomes truly expressive of emotion in a way that the face does not do, and this is different than the face. It's the body. Franz Rogowski thinks of himself less as an actor and more as a piece of sculpture.
I can see that. Yeah. His body is such a, he really tells stories with his entire body.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, he said to me once, you know, if he's going to put his hand on a wall in a moment of silence, he's like, what does my hand mean? So, but we don't talk about that. That's unspoken between us.
Yeah.
I mean, he'll tell me that that's how he works. But with my actors, I don't rehearse before I start shooting. I spend a lot of time working on their costumes, and we spend a lot of time trying on clothes, which is a wonderful way of getting intimate with somebody.
Yeah.
And also creating character. But we don't talk about backstory. We don't talk about motivation. I try to avoid conversations that will literalize meaning.
Okay. This makes me think of a question that I had for myself while watching the film.
Yeah.
Because at a certain point, I kind of asked myself, do I understand these characters? Do I even want or need to understand these characters? Or do I just want to experience their story and then maybe have some questions and move on with my life? And that made me wonder how that is for a writer and a director to create a character. Do you feel like you need to fully understand them to create them, or?
Well, I would like to ask back, do you feel by the end of the film that you have an understanding of who these people are, or familiarity?
To a certain extent.
I think for me, I believe in the power of observation. And that doesn't mean necessarily control. It does mean some moments of identification, in the sense that I think if the film works for people, they go from being on the outside to on the inside.
Yeah.
And I think for me, that's how I think of movies in general, and particularly constructing them. It is a series of middles for me. There's no beginning and there's no end. And that's true scene by scene. You're always thrown in the middle. And I guess that draws upon like the history of cinema verite. It's not a verite film, but it works with verite tropes in the sense that the world is happening and the camera somehow gets the opportunity to be there.
Yeah.
But the world is happening whether you're there or not. It should be the sense.
Yeah. Yeah, this was one of the a note that I made while I was watching the first time, because one of the very first things that piqued my interest that I noticed about the film is that the pacing is quite quick. I think in the first 15 minutes or so, Tomas has already left his husband, moved in with his new lover. And the thing that makes it quick, not just because of the time frame, but also because a lot of these big decisions are happening off screen.
Mm-hmm.
So in the first 15 minutes or so, I was like, ooh, I feel like I've missed things. Mm-hmm. But then while the film continued, it was such a different form of intimacy that indeed lets you understand the characters to some extent because you see very different moments than you would normally when it's really driven, the action is really driven by those decisions. I think you get to know them in a very different way by being in these middles.
I think what you're talking about is a kind of visceral relationship to the character and also to the cinema, right? Like you're attached because of movement, because of emotion, because of color, because of beauty, and because of plot. Like I can tell you that there is a plot, but you might not notice it.
Yeah. Can you expand a bit on that?
Well, the film in some ways is very simply a story of a man who begins in a moment of domination and he ends on the floor.
Yeah.
And how does he get to the floor?
Yeah.
How did he get to the point where he has nothing? Mm-hmm. And that's the whole story. And every chapter is some question of you know, I try to think about suspense. In the sense that, like, in each scene, something is missing that the characters want that will not be answered until later. Mm-hmm. So it won't be answered in the moment, but the question will be shifted. Every scene has a value dramatically, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, because I heard you talk in an interview about that you very much so believe in a motivated cut, which... Mm-hmm. Ties back to what you said, that you are interested in movement and getting there without cutting.
Well, I guess I just, I feel like I want to show that I'm really, I want the feeling that I'm really attentive, and a cut means that my attention got lost. I think I was just thinking about, like, it's like analysis. Like if you're in psychoanalysis and there's an analyst and there's an analysand, and there's a patient, and you really want to be interested as an analyst in everything that the patient is talking about. That's kind of your job.
Yeah.
But the truth is there's another patient in the next scene. So it's like, it's the cut between patients.
Right.
But in the moment, you have to be very, very interested.
Oh, that's such an interesting analogy. It makes me understand much more what you mean by the motivated cut.
So it works. My metaphor works.
It definitely works. Yeah. So the story takes place in Paris, but you wrote the script not in Paris, right? You wrote
it in the
US.
Yep.
And it was not always meant to be set in Paris.
Correct.
So in the end, how influential was the city to the story itself? Did it change after the location changed?
Oh, it certainly changed. And I couldn't have said it in many cities besides New York and Paris. Maybe those were the two options for me as an artist, because they're both cities that I'm extremely familiar with and have had a life in. So Paris in 1986, I lived there as a student. I was maybe 20 years old, and I didn't... have any friends, and I didn't speak French, and I was pretty depressed, but I was there, and I ended up really finding my sort of salvation, my companionship in the cinemas. I went to the movies 2 or 3 times a day for 3 months, and I saw 197 movies in that period of time, and it was just a transformative experience. I discovered a lot, and I discovered a really intimate relationship that I had with cinema, but also the history of cinema, like, which is continued to this day. Since then, I've just gone back to Paris as a place to live and to experience and to for long enough that I've had real relationships there. I've had breakups there. I've had sex there. I've cried there. I have really wonderful friends there. It's a place that I feel at ease. And I think that ease is really what allowed me to make this film there.
And do you feel like the city itself has a big influence on the story and the character development?
I do. I mean, I think it's not a touristic Paris in the film. There's a lot of interiors. It's a lot of bedrooms and apartments. But it's there's a certain kind of history that I think you feel in the images, and I think significantly the film ends in the streets of Paris. Yeah. And in a way, the story that is this fiction becomes subsumed by the city, which is real.
That final sequence of Franz or Thomas riding his bike into the city, that it was touched upon yesterday in the Q&A as well. That was such an interesting way to end the film. And to me, it all also almost felt like we as an audience were kind of given back to the world. Mm-hmm. We were in this very intimate setting all inside, and now kind of step out by going back into the city.
Yes, I think that was part of the intention. My films tend to end they end with a kind of open sensibility. Mm-hmm. They're not resolved, but I hope that they are finished.
Right.
Like, I hope that I've given, the kind of unity that's asked of, like, Greek drama. I hope that I've fulfilled that unity.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you did.
I also was really just struck by how good a bike rider Franz Rogalski was.
Yeah.
And I knew that, and I really built the scene based on the fact that he's, like, a crazy man on a bike and could do this really extremely physical kind of performance in the streets of Paris on his bicycle.
Yeah. They were all the scenes where he was biking were, even though not much happens because he's just on his bike, they were so beautiful to watch. And you said that he at some points even reached 50 kilometers per hour, which is crazy on a bike. How was it to film that?
It was really fun. It was kind of it was kind of dreamy to be running around Paris. And also I was watching the images. Mm. So there was a bit of ecstasy to the fact that we were achieving something that you can't imagine until you're starting to do it. I mean, that's true with basically every day of shooting a film is this kind of conflict, almost battle with what is possible. Mm-hmm. And there's this great anxiety as a director, which is very personal and somewhat, it's, you're the only one who knows how much is at risk. Like, it might not happen. Mm. Everybody thinks it's all going to happen. Like, everybody thinks that there's some kind of, well, we're shooting a film, we turn on the camera, we have actors, we have everything. It's just going to happen. And what I know as a director is it takes a certain kind of miracle. Mm-hmm. For something to happen that's actually worth being part of your movie. And there's always a chance that it won't. And so I think in shooting that scene and suddenly seeing the images and on the monitor as we're shooting it, we're in a truck and we're following with the camera. At some points, Franz is actually holding the truck. That's why we're able to have a sustained close-up.
I was wondering,
And I'm seeing just what's coming into the screen, and there's great pleasure because I'm fulfilling some idea that I can only know once I see the image.
How does the choice to not rehearse, how does it factor into this risk for you?
It's the risk that actually gives the possibility of making the images that I want. Like, because what I'm looking for is the thing that can't be said. So the way your eyes just went to think.
Yeah.
In your head. And that, to record that, I can't write that. I can only observe it.
Yeah. So what is your process of preparation then? If you don't rehearse, you said that you...
My process of preparation is extremely, it's not obsessive, but it's, and hopefully it's not academic, but it's very, very thorough in the sense that if I'm not working with my actors more than a couple of hours a week in pre-production, mm-hmm. I'm working with my cinematographer, in this case, José de Haye, like 5 hours, 6 hours a day and for many weeks mm-hmm. to be prepared to shoot the film, because I don't go into a scene without a strategy in advance of how the camera is going to interact with the actors and space. Mm-hmm. And to figure out that language is for me a very lengthy process, which involves a close study of other movies and other shots and other images. I use references all the time in my work that kind of lead me to new ideas. I'm very prepared, And then something unexpected has to happen.
That seems like a scary process.
Every day, I mean, when I'm done shooting a film for the next like 4 weeks or 8 weeks, I dream every night that I'm on set because the tension is so high.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter. I mean, it's just a movie. Like I have a sense of humor.
Mm-hmm.
But I know how possible it is to not get what we need. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that nobody else really does know that. Really, nobody on set knows that.
No, not even your director of photography?
No, not the way that I know that. I mean, they have an enormously difficult job. They work harder than I do because they don't get a DP doesn't get time off on set.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Like I get like I suddenly have blocked a scene, talked to my camera people. They're setting up lights, and I can go have breakfast and I can go talk to friends on the phone. And mm-hmm. you know they don't really get to do that, so they work incredibly hard.
Yeah.
But they don't necessarily need to figure out the solutions
right
when things aren't working. Like they don't know what to say to an actor or how to reblock.
Yeah.
And they trust that you will.
Yeah.
You're the one.
You make up for that free time in your dreams the weeks after.
That's right. That's right. Because you're always aware that you might fail.
Yeah.
I think what happens, which is nice, is that I actually edit when I'm shooting. So,
oh, right.
I mean, I don't, but my editor does.
Right.
And I'm given scenes pretty quickly after,
mm-hmm.
and I start to go like, oh, it's work. Like day one is terrifying and usually a failure, which it was in this movie also. I literally come home and I have to call several people to make sure that there wasn't a huge mistake made by the people who gave me money to make the film.
Okay.
That's day one.
Okay. In what way was it such a huge failure to you?
The scene was bad. I mean, to be honest, the scene in the bedroom where you see Franz's back.
Yeah.
That was on day one, and we probably shot maybe another hour of footage.
Mm-hmm.
I needed an authentic moment between these two actors in this room, and that was the only one I had. So okay. There was not a choice. There was not, and I got it. That's
uh-huh.
all you need. But there was another scene I shot that day that we didn't use, and is also not good. It was a scene that I learned a lot from because it really wasn't a scene that fit into the kind of movie I was making. It was a scene in which Agat and Martin were talking about their past. They were mm-hmm. sharing stories of their past. I think of it as a Jules et Jim scene,
mm-hmm.
like it's a storytelling scene,
mm-hmm.
and that this movie has no past.
No,
it just there was no space for it in a aesthetic way.
Mm-hmm.
So it failed because it wasn't right. So that's an example. Those things happen and they weren't right, but they were also day one.
Yeah,
and by day five, I'm actually seeing my scenes, and I feel just I feel a kind of excitement and confidence because I see things are working.
Yeah.
And then you just proceed.
Yeah. Do you then often go back to scenes to reshoot them?
No.
Or do you work with whatever you had?
No, I almost never reshoot.
Okay.
I don't give myself that option. I don't have it in terms of time. I also don't think I think better to assume this is it. I do always on a day of shooting think, can the movie live without this scene? And I usually convince myself that it can, which allows me to calm down. Because I think it's okay. I'm going to do the best I can. And I hope I get something. But can the movie live without this scene? And there are some scenes the movie cannot live without.
For sure.
But a lot of them that can.
Yeah. Moving back a little bit. The scene where Thomas and Martin are having a conversation on the bed.
Yeah.
And we see the back of Thomas and mm-hmm. he's completely blocking Martin. Do I understand correctly that you never intended to shoot it that way?
Correct.
Wow. And it was so speaking that it was done this way. I thought it was like a crucial point in the film.
No, not at all. And you can actually see Martin. You can just see the side of his face,
bit.
Is really significant. And
yeah.
I think you're not, but no, that wasn't, I'm not that self-conscious with my work. I mean, I think that's, I'm glad about that. Like I'm trying not to impress.
That's not a sentence that I thought I would hear a film director say ever, I think.
Well, I think the best work seems effortless.
Mm.
You don't even notice. I mean, I think of Ozu. Yeah.
Sorry, what did you say?
I think of the Japanese director Ozu.
Mm? I don't know him.
Oh, you got such a great thing to discover in your life.
Yeah.
He's one of the greatest film directors ever. And one of the things I love about Ozu, so he was a Japanese director from like the 30s until probably the mid 60s. And he made many, many films, like 45 films.
Oh.
And they're in some ways all about the same thing, which is like family life.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens between parents and children and sisters and brothers. And I mean, they're all really very, very similar. And each one is as different as our own lives. And for me, he gave me permission to say, like, to be interested time and again in the same questions. And he's also, the films are super everyday and super magnificent.
In that non-impressing way that you talk about?
In that non-impressing way. I mean, the impression, Ozu is as good as Shakespeare, really.
Wow, okay.
Like, he's as good as any writer ever.
Mm-hmm.
It's the most beautiful human cinema.
Wow, I am now definitely looking forward to watching his 45 films.
Yes. Well, you know, I hope the best way to watch Ozu, to be honest, is in a festival.
Oh, right, yeah.
Like to actually be like, oh, they're playing Ozu. I'm going to go to a bunch of those.
Right,
because then you're going to, that's what I did. And that with my co-writer, we discovered Ozu maybe 10 years ago in Memphis together. I mean, not Memphis, in New York together. And it changed our writing. It changed our lives.
Yeah.
And it's not necessarily for the small screen.
I will have to find a festival then where they show his films. If I don't, is there one film that you would recommend above the others?
Late Summer is a wonderful, wonderful film. There are all the time. There's like Early Spring is a great film. Late Summer is a great film. I remade two of his films as Little Men. It was one film. He made a film called I Was Born But.
Yeah.
Which is a black and white silent film that he made in the 30s. And he remade it as a film called Good Morning.
Okay.
And they're both about children who go on strike against their parents.
Mm-hmm.
Those are very like, that's a very sweet way to start. Those are childhood films and others of his movies are really about like, what it is to like accept the limits of one's life and the limits of one's commitment to others, but with so much compassion. I like gaps. To me, like gaps are these things that give you a sense that maybe your life will be transformed.
Yeah.
Right. Like maybe there's something you will see in a cinema that will change your life forever.
Yeah. I definitely felt those gaps in Passages, I think.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Just to end off, I would like to point out something that you said yesterday during your Q&A that really stayed with me. You said that you find comfort in people struggling to be with each other, which I thought was such a striking comment.
Mm.
And to end, I would like for you to expand a bit on what you mean and how viewers can find this comfort in your film.
Well, what comes to my mind is I find comfort myself in art and in literature specifically and in cinema storytelling. I find familiarity of things that I felt in my own life. I might have felt alone. And I think to see myself through other people's stories is a way of loving myself in some ways. Like being gentle on myself. I think about, we have in America the 12-step programs like AA and Al-Anon and these kind of things. And I participate. And even though it's an anonymous program. But and what I love is like the listening to stories of other people, which allows you to reflect on your own experience and your own And the ways in which you're hard on yourself. And somehow I think cinema allows us to embrace those things that we struggle with.
If after listening to this episode, you would like to see Passages for yourself, it is now available on Mubi.com. Want to know more behind the scenes details? We were also recently in conversation with filmmaker Marussia Sirujkovskaya to talk about her stunningly heartbreaking film, How to Save a Dead Friend, which chronicles her life with her lover and best friend, Kimi, against a backdrop of Russia's authoritarian regime. You can listen to the conversation on our website or on any streaming platform.